all the world.
Joseph Borrell has told EU foreign affairs ministers the talks in Vienna, Austria are extremely delicate, sensitive and intense. He says he's optimistic and a window of opportunity will stay open until the end of this month. Nothing is agreed until everything is agreed, he insists. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
According to the spokesperson of Taliban, the group's leadership has ordered all members to stop fighting during the 3 days of Eid al-Fitr that mark the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Taliban also say the group's leader has ordered all members not to enter government-controlled areas during the three-day ceasefire and that they would not allow government troops to get into Taliban-controlled areas in the same period. The declaration of three-day ceasefire by the Taliban has been widely welcomed in Afghanistan. Locals who are bearing the brunt of violence say they expect the Taliban to agree to a permanent ceasefire in the hopes that it would lead the country to a lasting peace.
Nonetheless, we welcome the three-day ceasefire by the Taliban, but I think temporary ceasefires are not viable long-term options to put an end to our misery. So we want the Taliban to approve a lasting ceasefire instead of insisting on war.
Taliban approved the three-day ceasefire as Afghanistan witnessed a sharp increase in civilian deaths due to rising terrorist attacks such as car bombs or explosions over the recent months. On Saturday, three separate heavy explosions went off close to a girls' school in western Kabul. 68 civilians were killed, most of them young girls. Also, over 160 others were wounded in the incident. This grim attack occurred just 2 days before the Taliban militant group declared the Eid ceasefire. Meanwhile, many have called on international players to put pressure on the Taliban to approve a permanent ceasefire.
The ceasefire is good news for us, but our oppressed people deserve lasting calm and security as they have tolerated a decades-long bloody war. Therefore, some foreign states who had promised us to bring peace in our country must fulfill their obligation.
This is not the first time the Taliban approves a short-term ceasefire since it was removed from power back in 2001. In June 2018, the Taliban approved a three-day ceasefire. During that period, some Taliban militants entered Kabul and even took photos by Afghan armed troops. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Here at the Higher Constitutional Court, the final list of those eligible to participate in Syria's presidential elections has been announced. This comes after a week from the initial announcement, which was a period of time given for objections, which reached six. All have been declined.
The court rejected all objections due to the lack in the legal and constitutional terms of their applications. Thus, the final announcement is as follows. The court has accepted Abdullah Abdullah, Bashar al-Assad and Mahmoud Meri as the final candidates in the upcoming presidential elections.
Abdullah Abdullah is a former MP and Mahmoud Meri is a Syria-based opposition figure. According to the court, candidates are allowed to start campaigning on the 16th of May. 10 days before the date of the elections in Syria. However, individuals and even public and private bodies have already filled the streets of President Assad posters in a wide show of support that indicates who is likely to win. Presidential elections this year are different from any previous ones from many aspects.
I expect a large participation by voters this year because so many parts of the country have become secure and under government control. We have three candidates and Syrians will decide who the winner is.
Previous elections were more difficult from today during the war because of terrorist mortar attacks. Today I see Syrians more excited to take part in elections and vote.
This is an unprecedented election process in Syria's history, as for the first time, more than 50 persons applied to become a candidate, among them women. In April, the People's Assembly officially announced the date of the elections, including the terms that should be met for those who wish to run, which included the votes of at least 35 MPs. All eyes are on the presidential elections in Syria, a process carried out according to the country's constitution. Despite the fact that so many countries known for their hostility to Syria are against the elections, the Syrian government is keen to abide by the law and send a message that only the Syrian people are entitled to decide the future of their country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Moscow consistently defends international law and at the same time will firmly defend its national interests to ensure the safety of its people. He made the remarks during a speech to thousands of soldiers and veterans on Red Square during the annual parade, which marked the 76th anniversary of victory in the World War II.
Our people know too well how this can end. Russia is consistently defending international law while continuing to protect our national interests and the security of our people. Our guarantees are the glorious Russian armed forces, descendants of the victorious troops, and of course our joint efforts for the sake of our country's development and the well-being of Russian families.
Vladimir Putin voiced concern over what he described as a creeping return of ideologies of the time when slogans of racial and national superiority, of anti-Semitism and Russophobia became even more cynical.
Unfortunately, attempts are made to deploy a large part of Nazi ideology and the ideas of those who were obsessed with the delusional theory of their own supremacy. This ideology is not only supported by radicals and international terrorist groups of all kinds.
The parade was participated by more than 12,000 troops, 191 units of military ground equipment, and 76 planes and helicopters. Military parades and festive events commemorating the Soviet victory took place in almost all Russian cities.
I consider the Victory Day as the greatest holiday of Russia. Many Russians lost their life to liberate Europe. Victory is victory, and it was very, very difficult. This is a great day for the Soviet people. Our republics of the Soviet Union won a great victory. Some powers are seeking to distort history. They say that the victory was won by the Americans, French, or Britons. It's a lie.
This year's parade comes at a time when Moscow's relations with the West are severely strained over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine and the imprisonment of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned last week that relations between the Kremlin and Washington could plunge to the Cold War level if Washington continued to reject a dialogue with Moscow.
The Soviet Union lost about 27 million people, 40% of all human losses in the World War II. A significant part fell on the civilian population of the country. According to the Soviet Extraordinary State Commission for the Establishment and Investigation of the Atrocities of the German Fascist Invaders, about 2,000 cities and towns, over 70,000 villages in the USSR were completely or partially destroyed by the occupiers. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Administered Kashmir witnessed the death of one of its prominent pro-freedom leaders in an Indian-run jail this week. Ashraf Zarrahi's death has raised concerns about the scores of political prisoners languishing in Indian prisons as the country combats a fresh surge in coronavirus cases and deaths. That amid testimonies by members of the 78-year-old's family who said he died due to lack of health care and improper prison conditions after he tested positive for coronavirus. Now families of other political prisoners fear they could also face Zarrahi's fate. The father of the 19-year-old Seher Shabir has spent 33 years of his life in different Indian detention centers. Shabir Shah is in prison for actively supporting Kashmir's right to self-determination.
My father's health conditions are not really good, and I and my family fear a lot in this case because he is having already many serious health ailments, and his life is in danger because we can't take the risk right now as COVID is increasing day by day and he has been denied treatment. Also, apart from all this, we have no contact with him.
Seher's father is among scores of Kashmiris who are imprisoned for supporting the region's independence from Indian rule. They are incarcerated under India's Public Safety Act, a preventive detention act that authorizes detention of any person for up to 3 months without a trial, and the detention period is extendable. Rights groups say the law has often been exploited to keep pro-independence supporters behind the bars. Human rights activist Ehsan Untu was also jailed recently. He says the central government has made it difficult to bail prisoners out.
The treatment of Kashmiri political prisoners in India is unfair. We are often kept with the criminals and are denied basic health care and medical attention. The entire setup is against Kashmiri prisoners. Even courts do not hold fair hearings. The international community must take action. out. Otherwise, no Kashmiri will walk alive from Indian jails.
Due to the raging pandemic last year, India's top court handed the decision to release prisoners on interim bail to the powerful state committees. Around 45,000 prisoners were released under the guidelines. However, not many of them were from among Kashmiri political prisoners. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Tens of thousands in Paris, more than 100,000 all over France, took the street in a massive protest against the climate law, voted earlier this week in the French Parliament. The demonstrations took place in a festive atmosphere, with a lot of colors and animation, and with a lot of young people coming from different social backgrounds. The awareness is rising, and more people are getting convinced that significant measures have to be taken to save the planet. But that's not what the French authorities are doing, they say.
This law is ridiculous, because the President of the Republic promised 150 climate measures. Finally, only 29 were retained. Regarding domestic flights, thermic efficiency of apartments, and renewable energies, this is really the minimum of the minimum. Our group in the Senate will oppose this law next month. We are going directly to a catastrophe if more urgent measures are not taken.
Earlier this week, the French Parliament voted a climate law after 110 hours of debate, a record. The main points of the law are ban of domestic flights if the distance can be done by train in less than 2 hours, ban of renting very poorly isolated apartments, stimulating the use of especially electrical bicycles. But this is far from being enough for the more than 600 associations who organized these marches and who consider French President Macron responsible for the passivity on climate issues.
A real planification should be made to leave the nuclear energy behind us and to invest in renewable energy. This government does not have a budget for the thermic isolation of poorly isolated apartments, and it should really ban domestic flights and develop transport by train instead of privatizing the public transport. There should be taxes on big multinationals to create thousands of jobs in the development of renewable energy. Even Joe Biden in the USA has proposed these kinds of measures.
The High Council for the Climate, an independent body, declared that the French measures are insufficient to reduce greenhouse gases. The European Union as well is strengthening its ambitions to halt global warming. So, time for France to increase its objectives. But to succeed, the French authorities will have to hurt the big bosses of the nuclear and the petrol industry. It is not sure that they are willing to go that far.
Too little and maybe too late. That's the main sentiment here concerning the climate measures taken by the French Parliament. In June, the Senate will discuss the same text, and this citizen movement is very determined to keep the pressure high. Chris de Hont, Paris.
As COVID-19 cases continue to surge in Indian-administered Kashmir, Mohammad Afaq Saeed has been swamped with distress calls from people looking for oxygen. Afaq leads the oxygen campaign of a Srinagar-based NGO. His small team of dedicated volunteers is working round the clock to help COVID patients gasping for breath.
We have one of the biggest oxygen programs in this region, in Kashmir. We have a lot of oxygen cylinders and a lot of oxygen concentrators and non-invasive ventilation machines and other supportive equipment. So this way, a lot of pressure from hospitals has been released.
With the Himalayan region's healthcare system reeling under tremendous pressure, Good Samaritans and social organizations have come forward to extend helping hand to people in need. Athrod Kashmir, a prominent philanthropic organization based out of Kashmir's summer capital, has converted the region's Hajj House into a spacious 100-bed COVID center. The facility aims to cater to the rising number of COVID patients requiring hospitalization.
We have established this facility in collaboration with state administration. The facility has 28 beds with high flow oxygen capacity and 72 beds with oxygen supply. We will add 100 more beds here with oxygen support system very soon.
As hospitals are scrambling to shore up oxygen supplies, the authorities have decided to install over 30 new oxygen generating plants in the region. Also, the government is constructing a 500-bedded COVID hospital in central Kashmir's Budgam district.
500-bedded hospital.
The work on this project is to be completed within 35 to 40 days. The hospital will have 125 beds as intensive care unit, and rest of the beds will have oxygen supply system.
Meanwhile, COVID cases continue to pile up in Kashmir, with almost 5,000 cases and 50-plus deaths being reported on a daily basis. Authorities have already extended the lockdown in the region.
As second wave of COVID-19 pandemic continues to take toll on healthcare system here, experts believe the worst is still ahead. Amid the unprecedented surge of the infections, good Samaritans are lending a helping hand to the needy, even as fear and anxiety loom large. Sayyidi Safid, Indian administered Kashmir.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon thee. By Muhammad, the chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but thy generosity, and none supports but thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey thee. Worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security. And placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The debate.
Israeli forces continue their attacks on Palestinians in and around Jerusalem Al-Quds. Meanwhile, Israel has attacked and besieged Gaza Strip. Over 40 air raids have resulted in 28 deaths, but the Palestinian resistance groups like Hamas have fired hundreds of rockets into Israel, breaking the defense shield, killing two Israelis, and for some of the rocket fire to have even reached Tel Aviv. In this edition of the debate, we will look at this exchange of fire between Israel and the Gaza Strip, and how Israel remains vulnerable to rocket attacks from the Gaza Strip while trying to find out if there's a solution to this conflict. First, let's find out what is going on in Gaza. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon joins us from Gaza City. Ashraf, at this point, when we spoke last, it was during a time where there was an exchange of fire. Not exchange of fire, there was a barrage of rockets coming from the Gaza Strip, and that's not a scene that is seen quite often, but it was quite incredible. What happened at that time when we were speaking to put us up to speed as to what occurred there?
Yes, the Hamas's military wing, the Zin Qassam Brigades, at that time was retaliating to Israel's bombing and destruction of a 13-story residential tower west of Gaza City by firing nearly 200 rockets, most of them towards Tel Aviv. Hamas has earlier warned that if Israel destroys a residential tower, it will respond by hitting Tel Aviv, and Hamas has fulfilled its threat or promise. Since this Israeli aggression on Gaza, the Israeli regime forces have killed 28 Palestinians in Gaza, including 10 children, and injured close to 160 people. The situation is only getting more tense and more and much worse by the minute, as it's very likely that the Israeli regime will respond in a very tough way to the attacks or retaliatory rockets by Hamas. According to Israeli media, what happened tonight is the worst ever missile attack against the Israeli regime ever since its creation.
Okay, thank you for that. We appreciate it. From Gaza City, Ashraf Shannon, a correspondent there, I'm sure he'll be talking to us more about what is going on there. Let me bring in our guest for this edition of the debate. Journalist and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mustafa joins us from Algiers. And we have Rania Masri joining us, Lebanon's Citizens in a State Party. She's a member of, and she joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. I'd like to welcome you both. Rania Masri, our correspondent, talked about the tower that was leveled. It was a 13-story tower that brought about a reaction from you, as I noted there on your Twitter post. A 13-story residential tower to have destroyed destroyed hit with precision airstrike, as you wrote, by Israel during Iftar, a war crime, as you stated. Gave you that initiative to actually have that post or have that action bring about a reaction from you?
Well, it is a war crime in all simplicity. When you have precision targeting a residential tower during Iftar, so we can imagine 13 stories of a residential tower, we can imagine how many apartments are in those stories, how many families are gathered together to share their meal together, how many hundreds of people could be in that building, and the entire tower was destroyed. So we need to recognize this for what it is. It is a war crime, and these are war crimes that the Israeli state has been inflicting on the Palestinians since 1948, and we need to use our words very precisely. It saddens me to hear this expression, exchange of fire, being used on Press TV. What's used on Press TV is much better than what was used on the New York Times or the Guardian or the Reuters or other press agencies. But let us be very accurate. We do not have an exchange of fire. We do not have retaliation from the Israeli state. We have an ongoing crime of ethnic cleansing, an ongoing act of settler colonialism, an ongoing act of apartheid. One of the world's strongest militaries, supported by either directly the United States and Europe or England, or the silence of the other countries of the world, attacking a besieged, oppressed population that is hand-making their rockets. This is not an exchange of gunfire. This is the Palestinian stance of resistance, of survival, against a brutality that continues to exceed our expectations.
Based on that description, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, that our guest there made, which was very descriptive, and which I will refrain from using some of the terms that he said should not be used and pass on the message, maybe there's a different ballgame now. I mean, I'm not asking for military analysis from you, but I'm asking whether what we saw, which reached Tel Aviv in terms of this military rockets that are being fired, which leaves no choice for the Palestinians except for Hamas and its factions to do that, because nobody else is coming to the rescue of Palestinians, really, after what happened in Jerusalem at Quds. Do you think that'll change the calculations of Israel in any shape or form?
I think so, yes. I mean, already we've seen that the Palestinian people have shown incredible defiance by already returning to Al-Aqsa the following day from when they erupted, when the Israeli army erupted inside the place of worship and entered and violently abused worshippers. And yet, despite that, the reaction from the Palestinian people was to return and to say, here we are, we're still here. So I think that the more the Israelis push the Palestinians, the more they're saying, we're still here, we're not going anywhere, and we're going to resist whatever means we have. Now, of course, it's heartbreaking to watch, because we are seeing, as Rania Masri said, this is an incredibly well-armed people, an army, which gets $4 billion a year in aid from the US and all sorts of advantages to attack a population that has no army, no fleet, no naval fleet, no air force. Here they are resisting with the very, very little means, and yet they're still here, and yet they're still resisting, and yet they're still telling Israelis that they're going nowhere and they're going to have to deal with them. So the fact that they've reached Tel Aviv, and even though, I don't think that the number of victims are going to be very high, unfortunately, even though I think it would be fair to see that on the Israeli side, they should be experiencing what the Palestinians are experiencing. But I think despite that, I think symbolically to reach Tel Aviv in this way is a very good turn of events. And I think it is showing the Israeli side that the Palestinians are still there, they're still resisting. And it's a good point.
Well, Rania Masri, before we have any numbers being added to the number of dead at this point, it's up to 2,810 children involved. You would expect that there's got to be some kind of reaction to come through that would spell some kind of action to prevent what is happening. Aside from the rocket fire that's coming from the Gaza Strip, but we're not seeing anything except for maybe Egypt to have come out saying we tried talking to Israel or talking to Hamas and the factions. They're not interested in any talks at this point. What can be done to stop what is happening for this to continue, which will end up with more deaths and probably a lot more on the Palestinian side?
If you would allow me, before I answer your question, I just want to completely agree with what your guest said, and to add on to that, that we not only are seeing the amazing strength of a homegrown resistance in Gaza, but we are also seeing all of Palestine resisting, all of Palestine, 1948 Palestine, 1967 Palestine, all of Palestine. We saw this yesterday in marvelous images from Alid, from Nasra, from Tarshish, from other areas in 1948 Palestine. These are areas that have been occupied and oppressed and dispossessed by the Israeli regime for 73 years, and they are still rallying in support of the Palestinian flag and in support of their brethren in Jerusalem. So we are seeing something powerful here, not simply the physical resistance through the rockets, but the magnificent popular resistance throughout the land of Palestine. Hopefully we are seeing a third intifada, and hopefully that this third intifada throughout the land of Palestine will not only show the marvelous resilience of the Palestinian people, but will push the Palestinian people to dismantle the Palestinian Authority, which is one of the challenges, unfortunately, within the occupied lands of Palestine for the liberation, because the Palestinian Authority is still maintaining its security coordination with the apartheid settler state of Israel. Now, as to your other question, what can we do? Well, yes, we're not expecting much from the Egyptian government. We're not expecting much from any of the Arab governments. But we have seen wonderful protests erupt throughout the Arab region. We've also seen protests of solidarity erupt throughout the world. What we do need, and this is a very strong call issued by the Palestinians for decades now from the land of Palestine, what we do need for anyone who is outraged at this continuous crimes of brutality against the Palestinians, stand in support of the Palestinian boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Make it ring loud and clear. Support the BDS movement wherever you are. If you are in the United States, there's a particular bill that you could be supporting right now in the United States, which is a bill being presented by Representative Betty McCollum. She introduced a bill to prohibit U.S. taxpayers' dollars from funding the abuse of Palestinian children. This is unheard of in the U.S. Congress. It's bill H.R. 2590. It's very mild, but nevertheless, it is revolutionary in the United States. We need to be doing what the Palestinians are doing, letting the people lead so long as our governments are incompetent. The Palestinians are leading, not the Palestinian Authority. Let us, the progressive people of the world, also lead our governments into the light instead of simply sitting back and allowing these atrocities to continue under the headline of asking for calm from both sides. I do not ask for calm. I ask for liberation and equality.
Well, the liberation and equality is going to only come about if there's maybe, in one respect, a support that should be definitely evaluated and maybe directed, and that is coming from the U.S. For Israel. And Hafsa Qara Mustafa, in one of your interviews, you have said that Israel won't heed international law as long as it is under the U.S. aegis. Now, explain to us more and what it is that the U.S. is doing when it comes to Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians, and are we going to see anything that is going to put the issue of Palestine-Israel conflict on the radar of Joe Biden and his administration?
I think politically, we're not going to see much change. I think for the past 50 to 60 years, in fact, since the creation of the State of Israel, the U.S. has always had a very pro-Israel foreign policy, and it has become stronger and stronger with time. Perhaps there was a sort of a slight lull during the Carter years, but you know, since Reagan, it's been back, and it's a love story that sees no end. However, what we're seeing, which is very, very interesting, it's with American society, I think there is very much a shift of mood amongst Americans who are more and more aware of what is happening, they're more and more questioning the narrative within their mainstream media that always portrays the Palestinians as the guilty party and the Israelis as the victims. And they're now, thanks to social media, thanks to various alternative media outlets, they're becoming very much aware of the situation in Palestine and therefore have a means of expressing their support and pressure on local politicians who are running for office. So whilst 10, 15 years ago, it was a given that supporting Israel was a vote winner, today, in some areas of the US, that's no longer the case. And that can have impact in the long term. Sadly, I think in the short term, there is still very much at the highest echelons of American politics an idea that the US and Israel are tied together and that there's no really looking to sever the ties or at least sort of loosen them, mainly in terms of, for instance, the $4 billion that are donated to the US every year. And I think if there was some change, at the very least on that point, we would see some light at the end of the tunnel. However, I'm afraid that's not likely to happen. And this is what gives Israel the sense of impunity, that whatever they do, whatever crimes they commit, they know that they have the absolute support of the most powerful nation on the planet.
Well, let's break open the third intifada, if we may, that you mentioned there, Rania Masri, for the liberation of Palestine. I mean, when you even have anything that comes close to that notion being either tweeted, as you mentioned in an article that was then suspended in one of the tweets that you had, how can this actually come about? Is that what we're seeing right now? Because you have a camp that says without a leader on the occupied territories, a third intifada is something that's not likely to happen. Do you agree with that?
Well, let us remember the first intifada and the second intifada did not have leaders. They were youth-led. They were led from the bottom up, led out of a sense of outrage and led out of a clarity of political vision. And later, they developed leaders. So in one sense, we do not need a leader for the third intifada. In another sense, one can argue that we do have a lot of leaders. We have the leaders who have come before us and who have shown the way, not only the martyred Ghassan Kanafani, but the martyred Bassel al-Arash, who have presented a very clear path of resistance, the way that resistance needs to be multifactored, the way that it needs to be built on a number of different analyses. We carry the pen and we carry the sword. So if we look at what an intifada actually is, it's a popular movement, it's a youth-led movement, it's across all the territories, then yes, we are seeing the beginnings of a third intifada. Now, what is necessary for those of us who are not in Palestine, who are not in the Palestinian lands, the question for us becomes, how can we support the struggle for liberation? How can we support the struggle against apartheid? And here there are several things that we need to do. One, first and foremost, we must not allow any individual to be able to say the excuse of we did not know. We are getting video footage now from occupied Jerusalem that is showing the world what the Palestinians have been saying for decades about their home demolitions and about the settler state-supported violence. We are getting videos that show this. And just as the video of George Floyd caused the conviction of the U.S. policeman who murdered George Floyd and caused a resurgence of protest in the United States, the videos that come out of Palestine should make it clear that what Palestinians have been saying for decades is what we need to be listening to. We have those videos. We have the reports from Human Rights Watch, which is not in any way a radical organization. And Human Rights Watch recently stated that what is happening in Israel amounts to, and I quote, the crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution. We have these mainstream organizations that are finally agreeing to what Palestinians have been saying for decades. This can be the role of the people throughout the world to support the Palestinian struggle by making their voices heard, to support the Palestinian struggle by putting pressure on their governments wherever they can be, to support the Palestinian struggle by making sure that the narrative does not present this as a Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It is the occupation of Palestinian lands. It is a settler state colony. It is a racist apartheid regime. This is what people all around the world can be doing, and this is what is needed to be done, in addition, of course, to supporting the Palestinian liberation directly through whatever means possible.
A lot of things that Rania Masri says there, Hamsakar Mustafa, are things that obviously if there were a lot more voices across the world, especially if it comes to officials, to be raised, then maybe we could get something rolling. in order to get some motion into all the things that Varnia must reset. But what more could be telling than what we saw in the Gaza wars, where on our TV screens we saw the disproportionality of Israeli rocket fire killing people, Palestinians, right in front of our eyes. And we saw that through multiple wars. We have seen what's happening in the occupied territories in terms of the violations, report after report, and the most recent right now, perhaps some hope in the ICC investigation, though many are saying that's not going to amount to much. So a lot of it may be just a repetition, but in order to get a kind of movement going, when you even have the social media posts that are being censored and filtered on different types of platforms, there's got to be more of a push somehow to get this the Palestinian cause known. What do you think? What direction should this go?
The problem we're facing here, and we've been facing it since the situation began, is that the mainstream media outlets are still very much in favor of the Israeli narrative, and therefore they have this means of imposing their position on public opinion. So I agree that there's a shift, and I think we can all recognize that. But overall, the reaction to the Palestinian struggle, to the Palestinian suffering, is just not the same. So when Rania Masri mentions George Floyd, for instance, it took this huge proportion because all media outlets took on that issue and talked about it, and it was acceptable for high-profile personalities, celebrities, to talk about it and to condemn it and to join in the condemnation, which then led public opinion across the world to join these mass protests. To this day, if you look at carefully, you have very, very few high-profile people, celebrities, who are actually posting about the Palestinian issue. And those very few who do, for instance, then get attacked and get pylons on Twitter and social media for doing that. And so it remains the Palestinian cause, even though it's blatantly a war crime that is committed against an unarmed population, even though we're seeing apartheid, just as we saw 30 years ago against the black population of South Africa. Despite all of that, it still remains a very contentious point because the mainstream media and the mainstream and the Western elites have still made it out to be, they're still pushing the pro-Israel narrative, which means that it's a very touchy subject, and it doesn't allow this sort of mass movement to rise in favor of the Palestinian cause and actually pressure politicians in an effective way, in a way, for instance, that it was possible with the Black Lives Matter movement, with George Floyd, etc. So I think, again, even though we now have the option of social media and we now have YouTube and all the rest of it, and people are far more informed, I think we're still today, in 2021, we're still in a world where the information is dominated by mainstream outlets, and they're still dominating the narrative, which is therefore not having the impact that we'd love for it to have on the Palestinian cause.
Rania Masri, some U.S. lawmakers are very sympathetic towards the Palestinian cause, and they have voiced their concern, they have voiced their worry through one way or another, whatever channels they have used. Can you expand a little bit more for us on that and tell us if that's where hope may lie, at least in terms of them highlighting this, perhaps to make a difference in the way that the U.S. deals with Israel?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? Who has been...
The U.S. lawmakers. There's been a US number lawmakers. Of them who are who have voiced their sympathy towards the Palestinians. More is that a solution there, that from the American side, from within the Congress, halls of Congress, for U.S. lawmakers perhaps make a difference here?
The solution ultimately will come from the Palestinians themselves within the land of Palestine. Liberation will come from within Palestine. Support for that liberation comes from outside. And yes, we have been seeing more voices in the U.S. Congress than we've seen before. We have a handful of representatives in Congress that are speaking out in support of Palestinians, be they Representative Rashida Tlaib or Representative Ilhan Omar or a few others. And of course, the representative that I brought up earlier, Representative Betty McCollum, who has approximately 18 co-sponsors on H.R. Bill 2590. And H.R. Bill 2590 simply asks for aid to Israel to be conditioned. I mean, simply ask for conditioning the aid. So yes, within Congress right now, we do have a greater space than we have had decades earlier. But let us also make very clear that the difference between Trump and Biden is a very dangerous difference, because President Biden is simply a more eloquent version of President Trump, which, of course, it doesn't say much about Trump, but it says a great deal for people who want to accept the very dangerous narrative of two sides. I think what's critical for people to understand is, and I agree with your guest, that yes, we are not where we need to be on the Palestinian narrative. We have shifted the narrative a lot in the past few decades than where it used to be earlier, but we are still not where we need to be. And this is why it becomes absolutely fundamental for every individual out there, every individual who believes in the validity of the struggle for justice and the struggle against apartheid within the land of Palestine, not to be a spectator to these war crimes. We cannot afford to be spectators. Here is my call to support the BDS movement. Here is my call to organize wherever you are, and my call to my fellow Arabs wherever you are, that we can see that despite the normalization efforts, despite the very disgusting military agreements that have erupted between the UAE and others and the Zionist state of Israel, we are still seeing unity coming out from the people of the Arab world, and that is why we recognize that liberation for Palestine goes hand in hand with the democratic movement in the region.
Thank you. Sorry to have jumped in. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guests, journalists, and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mustafa. Pleasure. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From me, Kavitabwe, entire team here in the capital, to everyone, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
For the media concerned with speaking truth to power, the case of Sheikh Jarrah perfectly exposes the magnitude of Israeli regime hypocrisy and deceit, says Blaine Fernandez, author, in an article titled Western Media Continues to Report Israeli Regime's Blatant Brutality as Clashes and Scuffles. Stay tuned for more. Let's imagine some creative wartime reporting. On April 26, 1937, the inhabitants of the Basque town of Guernica clashed with German warplanes dropping high explosives and incendiary bombs. The town was pulverized in the course of the scuffle, and up to 1,600 people perished. Obviously, these lines would never be written by any non-delusional person, since the nature of power relationship between human bodies, on the one hand, and bomb-spewing airborne monstrosities, on the other hand, is quite clear. Yet, when it comes to the Israeli regime-Palestinian conflict itself, a euphemism for Israeli regime's forever war on Palestinians, the Western corporate media never miss a chance to report blatantly one-sided brutality as clashes and scuffles. Take, for example, the Great March of Return, the overwhelmingly peaceful demonstrations that began in the Gaza Strip in March 2018. According to the United Nations, the Zionist regime military killed 214 Palestinians, 46 of them children, in the context of the Great March, and injured more than 36,100. During the same period, by contrast, one Israeli troop was killed, and seven others were injured. The media take away from the same event. There were clashes. Now, the Zionist regime's ethnic cleansing operations in occupied East Al-Quds have provided news outlets with another opportunity to exercise their preferred vocabulary. insofar as they can be bothered to report on the events at all. 40 Palestinians, including 10 children, currently face eviction from their homes in East Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to make way for more incoming right-wing settlers. The latest round in a decades-long Zionist regime campaign of forced re-displacement of Palestinian refugee families from 1948. As if the injustice were not already epic enough, Israeli regime police have responded to protesters in Sheikh Jarrah by, inter alia, charging them on horseback and dousing the area with tear gas and skunk water, a delightful Israeli invention. On top of that, the Zionist regime security forces have assaulted Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque, firing rubber-coated metal bullets and stun grenades and injuring hundreds. But for the media, it's all in a day's scuffle. There were scuffles and clashes galore in the Washington Post, on the ABC News website, in the Guardian, at Fox News, and again at the Post. The BBC, for its part, has dutifully kept its audience updated about clashes and confrontations, while insisting that, in firing stun grenades and the like, the Zionist regime police have simply been acting in response to Palestinian provocations, just as the Israeli regime is always acting in response when it, like, slaughters thousands of people in Gaza. From the get-go, the success of the Zionist regime enterprise was predicted on a policy of ethnic cleansing, the same policy now playing out in Sheikh Jarrah. But it is not the function of the New York Times and like-minded publications to connect the historical dots and thereby provide a contextualized picture of systematic Israeli dispossession of Palestinians, as opposed to localized confrontations. Furthermore, by quoting patently ludicrous Israeli foreign ministry statements without making it clear that they are patently ludicrous, the Times is merely assisting in the propagation of the Zionist regime narrative and the normalization of occupation. Imagine for a moment that, say, the Foreign Ministry of Guatemala issued a statement claiming that coronavirus was transmitted by unicorns. Then imagine finding this statement reprinted in the U.S. newspaper of record without some sort of indication that the suggestion was, you know, nuts, and you get an idea of what the Palestinians are up against in terms of global media coverage. Were the media actually concerned with rigorousness and speaking truth to power? The case of Sheikh Jarrah perfectly exposes the magnitude of the Zionist regime hypocrisy and deceit. It's a damn fine point, indeed, if one considers the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians expelled from their properties by the fake regime of Israel in 1948 and the millions of Palestinian refugees currently denied their right of return. In other words, there is loads of stuff to be reported beyond the clash and scuffle business, if only the truth were marketable. Then, of course, there are the media interventions that make Western mainstream coverage look relatively sane in comparison, like the recent one in the Israel Hayom newspaper by Caroline B. Glick, who takes us above and beyond clashes and scuffles to a powder keg, courtesy of Washington. The prize for number one criminal offense thus goes not to the Israeli regime's ethnic cleansing, rubber bullet barrages, or police-induced suffocation, but rather to you guessed it, subtitles. And as the direct line between U.S. and Israeli regime epicenters of oppression shows no sign of slackening, a media that didn't toe that line would certainly be helpful.
morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.